I'm Angela, one of today's readers. Welcome to the primary edition of your local talking newspaper, covering St Albans, Harpenden and all the villages within the district. The piece of music that you've just heard is called Hooked On. We hope you enjoyed listening to it. We'll be playing all of it later on. As always, our thanks go to Goffby Music, who has allowed us to use this piece of music. Today's edition of your talking newspaper is for week ending the 6th of October 2018. And the news items come from the Hearts Advertiser and the Review. Today we have three other readers. They are Bill, Sally and Bill. And now here's my first news item. Could a new hospital be on the cards for Hearts? The NHS recently rejected the WHHT's plans to expand St Albans and Hemel Hempstead hospitals, necessitating Hearts Valley Clinical Commissioning Group, HVCCG, to consider building a new hospital on Greenfield land. The expansion proposal, which the NHS has been considering since February last year, was rejected on the ground that the estimated costs were between £300 million and £700 million, and they were too high. The new facility for planned surgery would be built between St Albans and Hemel Hempstead, while the Watford General refurbishment would continue as planned. Members of the New Hospital Campaign have long petitioned for an acute A&E hospital to be built central to St Albans, Watford and Decorum, instead of renovating the existing services at Watford General. West Hertfordshire Hospitals NHS Trust, WHHT, plans to develop Watford General, which is based in Vicarage Road, Watford, over a period of 12 years. But campaigners argue that the hospital is difficult to access via public transport and the redevelopment will cause severe disruption. Campaigner Andy Love, who petitioned for the new A&E hospital central to West Hearts, said, "The fact that WHHT and HVCCG will now have to review their long-term hospital plans is great news, but we are still a long way from getting the new A&E hospital that West Hearts so desperately needs, and what I and the new hospital campaign group have been calling for. The need for a new A&E hospital is even more critical, given that the population in West Hearts is due to grow by around 150,000 in the next 15 years. For WHHT to be now contemplating a new hospital for only planned care and outpatient appointments, operations involving risk require acute services to be available. It's not solving the problems residents have with West Hearts' current A&E hospital at Vicarage Road. WHHT needs to bite the bullet and build a new A&E hospital for the whole of West Hearts. This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity and a chance to leave a legacy for future generations to benefit from." Hemel Hempstead MP Sir Mike Penning has previously urged the government to back Andy's campaign and has welcomed the news of a potential new hospital. He said, "There's still a long way to go, but it's about time they wake up and smell the coffee. It's not only common sense, but proven to be the most cost-effective option. The new state-of-the-art hospital on a central site with room for expansion, level and free car parking would provide for communities of Watford, Hemel Hempstead and St Albans for the next two generations, if not more. It would also be ideally located to serve as a backup for any major incidents on the M1, M25, Luton or Heathrow airports and northwest London." HVCCG has invited Mike Penning, St Albans MP Anne Main, Hitchin and Harpenden MP Bim Mafalami and West Hearts MP David Gawk to attend a meeting discussing the proposals. Ron Glatter of the New Hospital Campaign welcomed the change of heart by health bosses, but questioned why Watford MP Richard Harrington was not included. He said, "It suggests that they are still looking at our areas divided in two, Watford and the rest. This approach is disastrous. West Hearts must be looked at as a whole, with an integrated approach to acute and primary care, which has been missing so far." A statement from WHHT and the HVCCG said, "We are continuing to work actively to secure funding for the much-needed redevelopment of hospital facilities. We are refreshing our strategic outline case at the request of NHS regulators, who want us to do further work on some aspects of our proposals in light of national funding pressures. While indicating that our case for investment is clear, they've told us that access to capital is extremely limited and our proposals must be affordable. NHS Improvement has asked West Hearts Hospitals NHS Trust to consider a phased redevelopment based on retaining emergency and critical care services at Watford General Hospital. This is still the most affordable and deliverable option, and also the least likely to affect patient attendance at neighbouring hospitals. The redevelopment of St Albans City and Hemel Hempstead Hospitals remains our agreed proposal for planned care, and we will use the refresh of the strategic outline case to revisit plans for these services. In particular, we'll look at whether there is the potential to develop a new facility that would offer a range of planned and urgent care services similar to those currently provided at St Albans City and Hemel Hempstead hospitals. More work is required to determine whether this is a viable option and has merit over the currently agreed option. Our priority is on putting forward realistic proposals to help us progress quickly so that we aren't at the back of the queue for funding. We will be holding some events to discuss this with residents during October and November, and we'll announce these dates soon.
Hello, this is Sally here reading your second article. Council pledges to replace library magnifier machine. Sight-impaired people in St Albans have scored a victory after Hearts County Council promised to replace a magnifier machine in the library. Dave Richardson of Drake's Drive struggles to see further than 6 feet in front of him, and he relies on a magnifier machine in St Albans Library to read letters, newspapers and the blurbs of books. He came and spoke to the Hearts Advertiser this week after the library's manager told him the machine had been removed from the library, which is based in the Maltings, and would not be replaced. He said, "They're taking away my little bit of independence. I called it my quiet friend. I could get a book and go and have a read. I used it every Saturday and in the week. When I get a book, I can take it to the machine so I can read the blurb and know if I'm going to enjoy the story." The manager told him that the machine was going because no one used it. But Mr. Richardson, who has to have injections into his eye to help him see, has been using it for 4 years and saw at least one other person using it. At home, he relies on a gadget attached to his TV, which he can scroll through text with, and he also uses a magnifying glass, but he prefers using the machine when he's in the library. He couldn't recall seeing any warning that the machine would be going. A Hearts County Council spokesperson said, "Hertfordshire libraries take feedback of this nature very seriously. The magnifier was removed from St Albans Library last year following a survey and equality impact assessment. However, in light of recent feedback from a customer, we have reviewed our provision and we will be re-providing an electronic magnifier to support all of our visually impaired customers as soon as possible." Mr. Richardson said after he heard the news, "I'm over the moon, really, because I was upset about it and I thought the little man was not going to win." After he found out the council planned to remove the machine, Mr. Richardson spoke to County Councillor Anthony Rowlands, and soon after, the library told Mr. Richardson they would install a new one. "I can go back to reading books and my papers," he said.
Hello, I'm Bill. The results of a poll back housing plans over the rail freight scheme. Poll results suggest a vast majority of St Albans people would prefer housing built instead of a rail freight terminal. To accompany Taylor Wimpey's launch of a housing master plan for the Park Street Greenbelt site, where a controversial strategic rail freight interchange, or SRFI, is also proposed, this newspaper set up an online poll asking residents what development they would prefer. With 1,600 votes, 86% of readers would prefer to sacrifice that land to housing. Just over 230 people opted for an SRFI, which is just 14%. Land and Planning Director at Taylor Wimpey North Thames, Andy Holloway, said, "We are, of course, very pleased with the results and somewhat overwhelmed by the number of responses. We believe that this gives a clear indication that the local community would prefer a garden village to the currently consented SRFI. St Albans District Council have proposed a 2,000 home development on the contentious site in the draft local plan, despite threats of legal action from SRFI developers Helio Slough. The document is currently out for a second public consultation until October 17th. Andy added, "We would urge those who do support the Garden Village to respond to the local plan consultation and make your feelings known to St Albans Council." The poll ran from September 12th to October 1st. Planning portfolio holder at SADC, Councillor Mary Maynard, said, "Firstly, I would say I'm not surprised, because that is what comes out of the ward councillors in the area, and anyone who has gone door-to-door in Park Street knows that's what residents want. Neither Helio Slough or Taylor Wimpey own the site, and both would have to buy it from Harts County Council if they want to progress with development plans." Councillor Maynard noted, "Generally, anybody can put in a planning application on any piece of land. The housing master plan included new schools, open spaces, health facilities, and the potential for a new bypass to Frogmore and links to Howwood and Park Street stations." A spokesperson from SEGRO, who own Helio Slough, said the SRFI is a nationally important infrastructure project that will play a key role in supporting the government's rail freight strategy, which includes getting more freight off the roads and onto rail, reducing HGV movements and improving air quality. She argued SRFI will also create local jobs in a post-Brexit world.
Hello, I'm Bill Lawley-York, and my first article is headed "Councils at Loggerheads Over Housing Allocations." History is repeating itself once again, as cross-boundary cooperation issues could put St Albans' local plan in jeopardy. The former strategic local plan was thrown out at High Court in 2017 because a group of neighbouring councils, the South West Harts Group, lodged objections to the document. Decorum Borough Council, Hartsmere Borough Council, Three Rivers District Council and Watford Borough Council together argued St Albans District Council had failed to properly cooperate with them when proposing thousands of new homes close to their infrastructure. After a £35,000 failed legal battle, St Albans District Council was forced to throw away more than a decade of work and start redrafting a new local plan. A letter seen by this newspaper shows that these issues are still plaguing the process. Assistant Director of Planning at Decorum Borough Council, James Doe, asks that 5,000 proposed houses sitting on the border between Decorum and St Albans be shared between both council allocations, as they will use infrastructure from both districts. The letter reminds St Albans District Council to be mindful of the clear advice of previous inspectors' report, arguing the allocation of such substantive development on the east and northern fringe of Hemel will have a significant impact on the local housing market for the town, Hemel Hempstead, and is likely to have a regressive impact upon the potential deliverability of the Decorum planned sites in and around Hemel. These 5,000 houses contribute towards a government quota of just under 15,000 new builds for St Albans District before 2036. If St Albans District Council agree to share the East and North Hemel allocation, the local plan will fall short of this quota. On the other hand, if St Albans District Council refuse to share, Decorum Borough Council may lodge another objection, undermining the document and throwing it off its target completion date in March 2019. The government has threatened to intervene with the local plan if that March deadline is missed. This would deprive local residents of a say on important issues, such as the location of large developments. Redbourne councillors have fought this draft local plan from the onset because lots of development is planned for the ward. Chairman of Redbourne Parish Council, David Mitchell, said he saw this cooperation issue coming. Decorum want some of the allocation because the infrastructure will impact on them, and I know where they are coming from. It seems to be that an awful lot of issues haven't been resolved since last time, and if Decorum lodge the duty to cooperate issue again, in all the work will be found unsound, and then we are back to beginning again. I will be disappointed if it falls on a duty to cooperate issue, because I thought there are other areas to address, such as infrastructure. I would like to see some progress, but it doesn't seem to be that the whole thing sticks together or gels. He believes the rushed document lacks enough detail or coherent argument, adding, "All these things are huge issues, and I don't see how it is all going to resolve. The more things get delayed, the longer it will take for housing to be built, and I'm the first person to say we need housing." James Doe, who penned the letter to St Albans District Council following a duty to cooperate meeting in August, said, "Decorum Borough Council continues to work constructively with St Albans District Council on planning matters, and duty to cooperate discussions are ongoing. The council will be considering its formal response to the draft St Albans local plan and will issue this by the October deadline." The local plan is currently out for its second consultation, ending on October the 17th. If needed, St Albans District Council say it will redraft the document before it's submitted to the Secretary of State for Housing, Communities and Local Government in March 2019. Information is available at the Civic Centre, on St Peter Street, at public libraries and at town and parish council offices.
Father launches petition to improve safety measures at Major Junction. Gregor Park of Waverley Road has a daughter who uses the crossing to attend St Albans Girls' School, Stags, and has noticed people crossing diagonally over the junction connecting Harpenden Road, Batchwood Drive and Beach Road. He said, "I was at the lights at about school pick-up time and I was shocked by how many people walked straight across. It's a potentially dangerous crossing and you have to do it in two stages, as if you try and cross diagonally, it changes before you can get to the other side. Someone said they thought it was perfectly safe when the light goes green to walk across the middle, which I would not advise my daughter to do, as I do not want her ending up in the middle of the road. It seems we have a crossing which is not doing its job." He believes the marked diagonal crossing would benefit pupils at Stags and Gardenfields Primary School and people living on Ellis Fields, Old Harpenden Road and Beach Road. The diagonal crossing would also, in Mr Park's eyes, help drivers, as it would mean not waiting twice in quick succession for people to cross in two stages. He said, "If you increase the time the green light stays on for, people would still walk across diagonally. I just thought it seemed more sensible to put a marked crossing where people can go diagonally across, as people have started doing." He's petitioning Herts County Council, and at the time of writing had already attracted 39 signatures in a week. Roma Mills, County Councillor for St Albans North, said, "I'm looking into it, and I've asked the officers to look at it in terms of safety and road traffic. A lot of work went into making that junction safe and to try and reduce the huge block of traffic from Harpenden, which you could get at that junction at peak times. You are, on occasion, going to have to cross twice, so I'll have to weigh the inconvenience of that with how safe it would be to cross a very wide junction diagonally."
Tunnel tracks in district indicate hedgehog numbers are worryingly low. New research indicates that hedgehog populations are declining around St Albans District and the rest of Hertfordshire. In the first systematic survey using footprint tracking tunnels to monitor rural hedgehog populations in England and Wales, the spiky animals were only found at 21% of 261 sites between 2014 and 2015. Monitors were placed near Tittenhanger and to the southwest of Wheathampstead, as well as to the west of Wellin, north of Stevenage, between Sandon and Kelshall, between Wild Hill and Bell Bar, and near to Wormley West End. The research also found that badgers were not present at many sites. Primary author of the paper and PhD student at the University of Reading, Ben Williams, said, "We found that although hedgehogs were generally widely distributed across England and Wales, they were actually found at a worryingly low number of sites." Writers of the research believe the declining number of both hedgehogs and badgers may be down to a land management issue, climate change, or both. A paper entitled "Reduced Occupancy of Hedgehogs in Rural England and Wales, the Influence of Habitat and an Asymmetric Intra-Guild Predator" was published in Scientific Reports. Ben continued, "Perhaps more importantly, our results indicate that a large proportion of rural England and Wales is potentially unsuitable for both hedgehogs and badgers to live in. Given the similarity in diets of the two species, one explanation for this could be the reduced availability of macroinvertebrate prey, such as earthworms, which both species need to feed on to survive. This could be as a result of agricultural intensification and climate change." He also noted that hedgehogs are increasingly using human habitats, such as gardens, as a refuge. The paper was led by Nottingham Trent University and the University of Reading, funded by the People's Trust for Endangered Species and the British Hedgehog Preservation Society. Grants manager at PTES, Nida Al-Fulaj, added, "Badgers are what's known as intra-guild predators, meaning they predate hedgehogs but also compete with them for food resources. This naturally makes their relationship complex, which we already knew, but until now we didn't realise the extent to which changes in the landscape were affecting both species."
Impressive local music stores praised in a new book by a vinyl records fan. A vinyl lover hopes to break records with his newest book, which features an independent music shop in St Albans. Graham Jones published his first work, Last Shop Standing, Whatever Happened to Record Shops, in 2009, after visiting thousands of music stores around the country. He believes he should be in the Guinness Book of Records for visiting so many record shops. Since his first work, which documented the decline of vinyl, the situation has taken an unexpected turn and record sales have started to thrive. The newest work highlights all 220 shops in the UK which stock new vinyl. It's called The Vinyl Revival and the Shops That Made It Happen. It features Empire Records on Heritage Close, which is described as an impressive site where you're encouraged to sit, chill out and listen to some good music. Founder Derek Watson owned comic store Chaos City in 2013. When an opportunity presented itself, St Albans HMV closed down and opened a gap in the market. Empire Records is aptly named after Derek's favourite film, a 1995 cult classic about a music chain trying to take over a small independent. Although Derek tragically passed away in 2015, the store has flourished under his partner, Marina Desclevis, and former HMV manager, Dave Burgess. The Liverpudlian author has been selling records, tapes and CDs for 32 years. He said, "I think vinyl has caught the imagination of the digital generation, of people who grew up with CDs and rediscovered vinyl, and although that may drop off, I think the future is fine because so many people have discovered the enjoyment of vinyl. Most people can remember the first record they bought, but they seldom remember the first track they downloaded." Even though that's his personal opinion, Graham stressed he would never tell other people what to do. He's about to tour around the country hosting events about the book. I meet people who are glad record shops are still open, and to see record shops going from vanishing to thriving is heartwarming. And I like to think I had a part to play in that.
A festival. Delicious dishes to delight at annual foodie extravaganza. Crowds throng to the city centre to relish local produce and sample tasty dishes at the annual food festival. More than 16,000 people visited St Albans St Peter's Street to peruse yummy offerings at the St Albans Festival site for 2018, which included around 70 food and drink stalls and two pop-up restaurants. Chefs from the Cookery Theatre also held culinary demonstrations of their signature dishes throughout the event. Children were kept entertained with face painting, coaster decoration, and a chance to meet animals from Oakland's farm. St Albans District Council's portfolio holder for business and community, Councillor Sally Gay-Gouzes, said thousands flocked to this fantastic foodie extravaganza that demonstrates the gastronomic delights available in St Albans District. This event really helps to showcase local food and drink producers, as well as the many restaurants, cafes, bars and pubs in the city. Visitors enjoyed food in the open air, listening to live acoustic music. The festival was organised by St Albans District Councils as part of the St Albans Food and Drink Festival. Hartshead property editor Jane Howell was at the event. She said there was a very good atmosphere and it was very busy. It was really nice that there were loads of options. This is all in spite of a fire scare on St Peter's Street around 10 a.m, just before the party was kicking off. Engines rushed to St Peter's Street to extinguish the blaze at Clinton's, but no one was hurt, and a hose reel was used to put out the flames. Other events in the St Albans Food and Drink Festival include Camera's Beer and Cider Festival and an Italian pop-up market. St Albans Business Improvement District George Street's Gin and Jazz event is still to come, where there will be cocktails, shopping and live music. It runs from 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. on Friday, October the 5th. Entry is free. The festival will culminate with an awards ceremony on October the 8th, when winners of an annual competition will be unveiled. More than 100 businesses across 14 categories have been nominated for the awards. And in the paper, there are a number of colourful photographs of the colourful crowds enjoying the food and drink and other attractions.
Absolutely no justification for Luton Airport expansion, say campaigners. London Luton Airport Limited, LLAL, is proposing to expand the airport's capacity to cater for up to 38 million passengers a year by 2050. The airport is currently ahead of schedule in its £160 million expansion to 18 million passengers per year, which is set to be completed by 2020. The Department for Transport, DfT, forecast is for an increase in between 20 and 50 million passengers by 2025. Analysis from anti-noise campaign group Harpenden Sky, however, suggests that other airports in the southeast of England will be able to provide more than enough demand for passengers' growth, with the CEOs of five main airports, including Luton, looking for planning permission to generate an additional 87 million passenger capacity. Neil MacArthur, chair of Harpenden Sky, said there is absolutely no justification for further expansion of Luton Airport. Ultimately, the cost of flawed Luton Borough Council investment planning will fall on passengers who already face some of the highest costs just to arrive at the airport, park their cars, or transport their baggage. Nigel Green, from St Albans Quietest Skies, said, London Luton Airport is 5 years into an existing expansion programme that was planned to last for 15 years. Already they're struggling to comply with noise controls agreed to cover that period. But rather than sort out the current problems, they seek yet further growth in passenger numbers, with a doubling of capacity over that already agreed. The current programme should be left to run until the original end date, during which time they should concentrate on resolving the existing problems of surface access, traffic pollution, and the relentless aircraft noise suffered by communities near unfairly routed flight paths. A spokesman for campaign group Stop Low Flights from Luton, SLFL, agreed, saying, Luton Airport keeps telling us they want to be good neighbours, but their actions belie this. Since 2013, they've more than doubled their night flights and increased by 90% the concentrated flights past Harpenden and St Albans. So, they've already had plenty of expansion. Rather than chasing yet more, they should stop and focus on actually delivering their promises to control noise. No further race for space until noise in this whole area has provably been reduced. The airport put in additional noise restrictions in June, which includes refusing any non-emergency flight diversions, refusing ad hoc flights during the night, and preventing operators from rescheduling daytime flights to night time. However, these restrictions, which are intended to minimise disruption to residents, will only be in place until the end of September. LLAL's Chief Operations Officer, Robin Porter, said, Long-term deportment, the government has stressed the importance of having sufficient aviation capacity, its important role in delivering its economic agenda, and is supportive of all UK airports making the best use of their existing runways. We've used these official forecasts of air passenger growth as the basis of our specific projections of how LTN might grow, taking into account the proposed development of a third runway at Heathrow and other airports making best use of their runways. We have just completed our initial consultation, and the high number of more than 800 responses received will help shape and inform the proposals. We are committed to minimising and mitigating impacts and to bring forward our proposals for long-term sustainable growth at London Luton in the right way. We plan to consult again next year on more detailed plans before preparing and submitting an application for consent by the Secretary of State for Transport.
A St Albans tree, which was planted to commemorate a First World War battle, has been shortlisted as Tree of the Year. The Verdon Horse Chestnut Tree in the village arcade was grown from a conker taken from the last tree standing on the battlefield of Verdon and the First World War. It was planted on January the 18th, 1976, and has made the shortlist for the Woodland Trust's 2018 Tree of the Year competition. The Battle of Verdun was the longest battle of the war, lasting from February to December 1916. After the war, acorns and conkers were taken from the battlefield and planted across the UK in remembrance. In 2016, St Albans Council installed a plaque next to the tree to mark 100 years since the Battle of Verdun, following a bid from St Albans Civic Society to acknowledge the tree's significance.
Inspirational art at the museum marks the centenary of women's suffrage. Inspiring St Albans women are being celebrated in an exhibition at the new St Albans Museum and Gallery. Artwork by Flea Cook and John O'Leary is being showcased at the renovated Town Hall, which was finished in June as part of the And So She Did season, commemorating the centenary of women's partial suffrage in 1918. The pieces were created by the artists collaborating with the public and are based on the lives of successful local women. Featured personalities include the warrior Queen Boudica, suffragette Lady Constance Lytton, first female mayor of St Albans Margaret Wicks, and Duchess of Marlborough, Sarah Churchill. The only living person to be commended is Saida Momataz Rahim, a Bangladeshi activist who is founder and director of Hertfordshire All Women's Trust. She said, "As a grassroots woman of British Commonwealth heritage, it's an honour and a privilege to be among such noble women of St Albans. Young girls and women should not let their social or economic background hinder their progression or contribution to society. And every girl or woman given the opportunity can shine and make a difference." Saida organises an annual peace vigil for the victims of the Manchester terror attack. It is a member of the St Albans Women's Interfaith Group and is fundraising for the building of a new Fleetville Community Centre. Museums manager at St Albans District Council, Kate Warren, said, "In this centenary year, we want to celebrate the many pioneering women connected to St Albans and inspire our visitors. It was wonderful to see so many families engaged in the activities, creating artworks and bringing the assembly room to life over the course of 2 weeks. We're thrilled to be able to extend this celebration beyond the summer and display the works in the assembly room at St Albans Museum and Gallery. Numerous events have been hosted as part of the And So She Did season, including craft sessions, theatre workshops, live comedy, suffragette jiu-jitsu, and a talk. The exhibition has been indefinitely continued due to popular demand. See it at St Albans Museum and Gallery."
Drivers have a shameful disregard for safety. The introduction of a 20-mile-per-hour speed limit on a road in Harpenden has met with concerns that it will not do enough to slow down traffic. The speed limit was put in place in Gravels Road, as well as the surrounding roads, as part of ongoing efforts to improve the safety of the street. Gravels Road has a one-way system between Eastmoor Park and the roundabout with Southdown Road, which has been ignored by some motorists. County Councillor Theresa Heritage allocated £13,000 of her highways budget to help improve the road, which included installing bollards and holding a consultation on the 20-mile-per-hour limit. Road resident Steve Gledhill said, "They included a 20-mile-per-hour speed limit on Cravels Road and one or two of the surrounding roads. I wondered if putting up the 20-mile-per-hour signs has really been of benefit. As far as I can see, it just looks as if the cars are going down the road at the same speed as before. They don't seem to be going any slower." I was in favour of it because it's a very narrow road, so ideally it needs some other traffic calming measures. But a speed limit is a start. I think what they should do in the short term is to enforce the 20 mile per hour and make sure people comply with it. Maxine Hayes, who lives in Luab Mews, said, "Personally, I strongly dislike the new 20 mile per hour signage. I noticed it immediately and think it ruins the look of the area and is wholly unnecessary. I also believe it has absolutely no effect on drivers." Cravels Road resident Roger Dean agreed, stating that the majority of drivers ignore the speed restrictions. He said, "When the new limits were put in, I hoped, perhaps not expected, the position would improve. It certainly has not. In fact, I really believe it is worse. The way many people drive along our street is nothing less than an invasion of our right to quiet enjoyment. Drivers have a shameful disregard for safety and reasonable behaviour." Councillor Theresa Heritage, who is councillor for Harpenden South West Ward, said, "I am pleased that residents in the Cravels Road area are happy with the installation of the 20-mile-per-hour zone, but I can also appreciate their concern that motorists are ignoring it. I am currently in discussion with highway officers about ways to increase the visibility of the zone and the potential for enforcement."
And now we have an interview conducted by Hartsad reporter Terry Hunt, and it's entitled "How My Grandfather Samuel Ryder Created Golf's Ryder Cup." Mary Moore is the granddaughter of St Albans resident Samuel Ryder, the man who created what has become the biggest golf tournament on earth. Mary lives in a village near Framlingham in Suffolk, where she and her late husband Hector ran their business at the Forge. Marrying her design skills with his craftsmanship, the couple created 50 signs for villages mostly in Suffolk, but also in neighbouring counties. When we meet, she is resplendent in her specially made Ryder Cup tartan and brooch. During our chat, it's quickly obvious that Mary has a fantastic memory for names, dates and facts, especially when it comes to the history of the Ryder Cup. She did meet her grandfather Samuel, but she doesn't remember it, because she was born in 1934, and he died 2 years later. So, he knew me as a baby, but sadly, I don't remember him. But her grandfather's creation has been very much a part of her life. She's been to 7 Ryder Cups in recent years, the first one being at the Belfry near Birmingham in 2002. The Ryder party, usually numbering 6 or 7, are able to rub shoulders with celebrity guests. Mary's still mortified that she didn't recognise Prince Albert of Monaco at one tournament. Mary, now 84, is president of the Samuel Ryder Foundation, an organisation dedicated to building awareness of the tournament's founder and the values which were important to him. Patrons include golfing luminaries Jack Nicklaus, Tony Jacklin, Colin Montgomery and Peter Alice. Samuel was a successful businessman in St Albans and also mayor of the town. Mary explained how the Ryder Cup came into being. He loved his sport and his first love was cricket. But his health was always fragile and his doctor suggested he should take up less strenuous sport. He joined the Verulam Golf Club in St Albans and he loved it. He was amazed how poorly golf professionals were paid compared to other sports, tennis players for example. Golf was very much the poor relation. He thought golf in Britain needed a higher profile and he arranged a friendly match between Great Britain and the USA. It was a great success and it grew from there. The first official Ryder Cup match took place in 1927. In recent decades, since the introduction of European players, the 2-yearly event has become much more competitive after previously being dominated by the USA. As a result, its profile has grown enormously, and it now stands as one of the world's sporting occasions. How does Mary think her grandfather would view his event now? He would be astounded. Whether he'd be happy with the scale of it now, I'm not sure. He never visualised this. Mary herself is not thrilled by some of the antics of spectators who get carried away by the excitement of it all. I'm not too keen when it gets too partisan. I don't think alcohol should be allowed on the course. But despite not playing golf, she says it's a great privilege to be so closely connected to the tournament. The first event she attended was in 2002 at the Belfry, which Europe won. Her first American event was in 2004 at Oakland Hills, which saw a record-breaking European victory. But her favourite tournament was in 2010, at Celtic Manor, a rain-soaked event which went down to the wire, with Graham McDowell clinching the trophy in the final singles match. Mary said it rained and rained so much that the tournament had to be extended to the Monday. So dramatic. That's my outstanding memory. Her favourite player, Colin Montgomery, because he spoke to me so politely and pleasantly at one of the Ryder Cups. Mary wasn't able to travel to Paris for this year's Ryder Cup, but followed the action closely on TV as Europe had a thrilling victory to recapture the trophy.
St Leonard's Church in Sandridge is holding a harvest festival service with farmers and their families. The service will be held at 6 p.m. on Sunday, October the 7th, for the Hertfordshire branch of the National Farmers' Union. St Leonard's vicar, the Reverend M. Coley, said, "We're delighted to be holding this service for the farming community in the county. Farmers and their families perform a vital role for society and are under great pressure." NFU Hertfordshire County Chairman Jamie Burrows said, "We're grateful to St Leonard's Church for hosting this service, which comes after an extremely challenging year weather-wise for farmers." St Albans Bishop, the Right Reverend Alan Smith, sent a message to be read at the service. "At this time of uncertainty, with Brexit looming, we want to work with you to ensure that we maintain the highest levels of food security, food quality and animal welfare possible. All the money given at the service will go to the Royal Agricultural Benevolent Institution."
A Harpenden couple have celebrated their diamond wedding anniversary. Jill and Clive Rawlins are delighted to have received a card from Her Majesty the Queen applauding their 60 years of marriage. They were teenagers when they met at a ballroom dancing class in 1953 and later waltzed up the aisle in 1958. Now 82 years of age, Jill and Clive have two children together and five adult grandchildren, aged between 20 and 28. Clive is a member and past chairman of Harpenden Probus Secundus Club and a social member of the Harpenden Golf Club, where he enjoys playing bridge. Jill was for many years a member of both Harpenden Ladies Probus and Harpenden Area Decorative and Fine Arts Society. She is also a keen gardener and nature lover. "She would even rescue a spider," said her daughter Sue.
To celebrate the Ryder Cup, the new St Albans Museum Gallery has updated the first floor display to highlight the city's connection through the prestigious golfing event. On display is Samuel Ryder's golf club, dated from the 1910s, and a golfer Ken Brown's Ryder Cup golf bag. He made the Ryder Cup team in 1977 and played in the Ryder Cup five times, 1977, 79, 83, 85 and 87. Ken lives in Harpenden and was an assistant golf pro at Verulam Golf Club, where Samuel Ryder also started his golfing life. On retirement, Ken designed golf courses for Aldwickbury and Harpenden Common golf clubs, and now speaks as a golf commentator, and is particularly known for his Ken on the Course segments. The museum's learning team have also created a family craft activity, focusing on the man himself, and families are invited to colour in and cut out their own Samuel Ryder statue to take home and display this weekend.
This is Rupert Evershed reading my monthly Nature Notes for the Hearts ad. Wasps are great, but there's a sting in the tail. A few years back, I was fixing a shed in our garden and had enlisted the help of my young son. We were busy moving rotten pieces of wood from the side of the shed when suddenly I felt sharp stabbing pains in my lower legs. Before I had the chance to investigate, my son started screaming in pain, and it took a few more seconds to realise that we were trampling on a wasp's nest. They were very angry, so we ran inside the house, stripping off as we went. My son had been stung all up the legs and was crying in pain. I had been stung quite a few times too, but tending to his stings thankfully provided just the distraction from the pain I needed. 20 minutes later, we were both virtually pain-free, but seared on our memories was the experience of encountering the wrong end of a wasp. Thankfully, neither of us had any allergies to such stings, but there are very few people for whom the mention or sight of a wasp does not immediately induce revulsion and varying degrees of fear. It is not hard to see how our dislike of the wasp, often extending to raw hatred, has come about. With their yellow and black striped jackets and facial markings that give the impression of an angry masked bandit, these little insects fit the bill as the bad guys. Reinforced from an early age with children's TV programmes such as Fifi and the Flowtots, featuring Stingo, the nasty troublemaking wasp, the wasp is one of the first characters of natural history we will become familiar with. On the appearance of a wasp, adults and children alike quickly recite that bees only sting once and then die, while wasps can keep on stinging. The ever-virtuous bee is cast as the noble character whose power is only exercised as a last resort, in contrast to the evil wasp, who may sting at will, and will sting. As if this isn't enough, they are at their most annoying at this time of year and into autumn, plaguing us at picnics and outdoor parties, and refusing to leave either our food or us alone. Their scientific name, Vespula vulgaris, seems to capture something of how we feel. They are vulgaris everywhere, and, well, vulgar. The vulgarity of wasps is exacerbated because, by and large, we see them at their worst. From late summer onwards, they have become little insect vagabonds, unemployed social outcasts who have hit hard times, and now, drunk on fermenting windfall fruit juice, hungrily seek whatever sugary sustenance they can find. With winter approaching, their fate is sealed. It is perhaps no wonder that we, who love sugary food too, should clash with this desperado at this time of year. But the wasp's sorry state at this time of year is not the whole picture, and earlier this year I got a glimpse into the world of this social and industrious insect that can equal any ant or bee in organisational efficiency. Walking along a footpath locally, I was stopped in my tracks by a persistent soaring sound next to me. Pushing aside the foliage, I eventually found a wasp busily soaring away at a dead and dry stem. Just last week, I found the fruit of his labours just a few yards along the bank. A hedge cutter had torn over the surface of the bank and revealed a wasp's nest built in the cavity of a fox's hole. The nest was ruined, and hundreds of wasps crawled over the remaining surface, busily repairing as fast as they could. Built from chewed-up wood pulp, wasp nests are a work of art with thousands of perfectly hexagonal cells to house the new wasp larvae. These larvae are fed by adult worker wasps, who in turn can feed on sugary droplets secreted by the larvae. The nest is the very definition of organisation, initiated by a single queen wasp and then built up and policed by thousands of worker wasps. The one aim to raise more queens to start next year's nests and males to mate with the queens from other colonies. Once this has been accomplished, or a hedge cutter passes by, the work of the majority is done, and the worker wasps must leave, jobless and in search of sugary sustenance now the larval supply has gone. This knowledge of their honest and hard-working beginnings may not be enough to move us to feel love and compassion for the wasp, but perhaps we can recognise that they are more than just a pest to be swatted. As predators, they play a vital role in controlling other potential pest insect and caterpillar populations, and have been shown to be a vital contributor to the work of pollination. Without them, we might just be worse off.
Right, this is Peter Burley bringing you a preview of events from mid-October to mid-November. And I must say, a slightly depressing run-up to preparing my script. The County Council's newsletter plopped through the door, telling me how to prepare for a really bad winter. On the other hand, I know you have got an entertaining late autumn coming up, so we'll get started. And the first thing I want to preview is Hertfordshire Jazz, which relocated to St Albans, but then didn't do much over the summer. But they're really getting into their stride with an autumn season now, and all these concerts are at the Maltings. On the 16th of October, we have a Clark Tracy Quintet. 23rd of October, Jim Mullen Organ Trio, and that's a guitar, organ and drums. 30th of October, Mo Foster and Friends, and a concert entitled Jill Evans in the Miniature. And Jill Evans is a jazz composer. Then on the 6th of November, we have Bridget Baraha's Babel Fish, Bridget Baraha being the vocalist in a small jazz group. And finally, on the 13th of November, we have Art Thiemann with the Clark Tracy Trio, making a second appearance in our period. Now, as I say, they're all at the Maltings. Doors for all the concerts open at 7 p.m. and the music starts at 7:30 p.m. They all finish at about 10 p.m. Tickets are regular £13, concessionary tickets £12, if you buy them in advance. If you turn up on the night, they're £15 or £14. All right, let's head for the cathedral. And we've got three concerts in our period. The reason there's only three musical events is that most of the period is actually taken up with various events around commemorating the centenary of the armistice in 1918. Anyway, the three concerts are starting on Wednesday the 17th of October, a lunchtime organ recital by Stephen King. That's at 12:30 p.m. and he's come from Brentwood Cathedral. Then on the 10th of November, the Lee Singers of Harpenden are giving a memorial concert, which is obviously themed on the armistice centenary, and there'll be music by composers from 1918. Tickets for that are £20 or £15 concessionary tickets. And then finally, we have a lunchtime organ recital again on Wednesday the 14th of November, 12:30 p.m. and that's being given by Anthony Grittin, who's head of undergraduate programmes at the Royal Academy of Music. I will carry on with one talk that's being given because it links in with that theme I mentioned earlier. On the 25th of October, there's going to be a talk at 7:30 p.m. on public memorialisation of the dead in St Albans from 1914 to 1925. And this is a talk about things like the street memorials, the war memorials, the civic ceremonies, all the things which took place commemorating people who died in combat. And it starts with what was done for the Boer War and runs through to 1925, which is when all of the war memorials we have today have been completed. Now, the price of that is £10, and it will be taking place in the boardroom in Holywell Lodge, and the speaker is Jonathan Mean from the Albans and Hertfordshire Architectural and Archaeological Society. Now, he gave a brief version of his talk to a conference last year, and I can tell you that brief version was very, very good. So I really can commend that talk on the basis of personal knowledge. Right, back to music and off to St Peter's, and we have a full house of lunchtime concerts. 17th of October, St Albans High School. 24th of October, Beaumont School Musicians. 31st of October, Harmony Musique. 7th of November, Alyssa Fiersova on the piano, and 14th of November, the Icknield Ensemble. I don't think I previewed them before, so I don't know what their ensemble actually is, whether it's a choir, musicians, both, whatever. Now, an event which I thought I'd include, but I couldn't really get to the bottom of exactly what's going on. There is a season all around the country of choir festivals, and they're gospel and community choirs. And there's an entry for St Albans, which comes up on Saturday the 20th and Sunday the 21st of October this year. And it's taking place in the High School for Girls, that's in Townsend Avenue. And it appears that you can buy tickets for it, but the website is incredibly vague about when it starts, exactly what's happening. The only thing it's very definite about is it will cost you £29 for one day or £42 for the weekend. So I'm sorry to be rather vague, but if it is a big choirs festival, it could be quite a big event. Now, we have got one freestanding organ recital at St Peter's Church. That's part of the International Organ Festival season. That's on Saturday the 20th of October. It's at 5:30 in the afternoon, and it's been given by Paul Gousseau from France. And then we have a concert called Sax and the City, and that's being performed by the St Albans Chamber Choir. It's on Saturday the 20th of October, 7:30 p.m. at St Saviour's Church. Tickets for that, well, are all £15. Now, the theme of the concert is to perform music which, I might say rehabilitates, but shows the saxophone in the light in which it was always intended, as opposed to being a slightly discredited instrument, which I think some people see it as. So it's a saxophone-based concert, but there are other instruments and there's vocals as well. Then the St Albans Choral Society have a concert on Saturday, the 10th of November at 7:30 p.m. And that's also in St Saviour's Church. And that's going to be Benjamin Britten's St Nicholas and also works by Petteris Vasks and Sibelius. It doesn't, unfortunately, give the cost of that. Now, we have a pretty full programme at both of our big venues. We'll start with the Auburn Arena. Monday the 15th of October, 7:30 p.m. We have Jamie Raven, who is a magician and is talking about his magic shows and obviously displaying his magic. Tickets for that are £22 down to £15. And we have a show called Rip It Up, starring Harry Judd, Aston Merigold and Louis Smith. Now, this is actually a spin-off from Strictly Come Dancing. And it's on Friday the 19th of October, 7:30 p.m. Tickets are £37.50, £30 or £22.50. But if you want to meet them, that will cost you £100. Whether that's a bargain at twice the price, I do not know. Then we have Neil Oliver, who is doing a one-man show entitled The Story of the British Isles in 100 Places. That's going to be Monday the 22nd of October, 7:30 p.m. Tickets are £22.50. And Jason Donovan is also doing a one-man show called His Amazing Midlife Crisis and just talking about his career and, I presume, doing some performing on stage. That's on Tuesday, the 23rd of October, 7:30 p.m. All tickets £25. Then we have a show called A Beautiful Noise, which is the start of a run of tribute shows. The Beautiful Noise is being made by Fisher Stevens and the noise itself is a Neil Diamond tribute concert. That's Wednesday, the 25th at 7:30 p.m. Tickets £29.50 or £27. Then we have Whitney, Queen of the Night, a Whitney Houston tribute concert, Thursday the 25th of October, 7:30 p.m, all tickets £24. Then we have Jackson Live in Concert, which is a Michael Jackson tribute concert. That's on Friday the 26th of October, 8 p.m, all tickets £23.50. We have One Night of Queen, performed by Gary Mullen and The Works, a tribute concert to the group Queen, Saturday the 7th of October, 7:30 p.m, all tickets £22. Now, breaking the mould of tribute concerts, we have a one-man stand-up comedian show with Ross Noble, and it's entitled Who is El Hablador? And that's on Tuesday the 30th of October, and again on Wednesday the 31st of October, both performances at 8 p.m, tickets for both performances £25. Then we have one man and a show called Stranger Things, and the one man is talented actor Charles Ross, and he recreates a season one of the Netflix sensation. I'm afraid it's not something I've watched, so I don't know quite what you're in for with this, but it looks like it's a satire programme, basically. That's on Thursday the 1st of November at 7:30 p.m, all tickets £22. And we have a big production by the St Albans Musical Theatre Company, and they're performing Ian Fleming's Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, and that's the musical. It's on the 6th through to the 10th of November, and performances are every evening at 7:30 p.m, and Wednesday and Saturday have matinees at 2 p.m. The only thing it doesn't say is how much it costs. Now, back to something where we do have the cost, which is £25. This is an audience with Simon Reeve. He's an intrepid journalist. He'll be talking about his career to date, reporting on stories around the world. He'll be talking on Sunday the 11th of November at 7:30 p.m. As I say, it will cost you £25. And we have Hazel O'Connor, not a tribute concert, the real Hazel O'Connor. Her most famous song is Breaking Glass. She'll be performing on Monday the 12th of November at 7 p.m. All tickets £25. And then we have, again, the real thing, 10cc will be performing. And they'll be performing on Wednesday the 14th of November at 7:30 p.m. All tickets £35. Now let's head north to Harpenden. And we kick off with another real band, not a tribute concert, Dr. Feelgood. It's all going strong after all these years. And that group will be performing on Thursday the 18th of October, 7:30 p.m. All tickets £18. All is standing only, so you won't be allowed to sit down. Then we have a show called Hits of Motown, and that is on Friday the 19th of October. It's at 7:30 p.m. All tickets £22.50, and it's a straightforward celebration of Motown music. And you have to sit down for that one. You can't stand up. Then we have Saturday the 20th of October. We have an electric and acoustic mashup with Glenn Tilbrook, who apparently is a very famous presence in the British pop world. I must admit, I hadn't heard of him before. Anyway, it's going to be a one-man music show. It will be at 7:30 p.m. All tickets £20 and all seats seated. Then we have on Tuesday, the 23rd of November at 7:30 p.m, a show called Sons of Pitches, accompanied by Jazz Ellington. This is a show that intends to showcase all aspects of pop music, and their aim is to perform 100 number one hits over the evening, ranging from everything from ABBA to rap to Beatles, the whole lot. Now, I say it's £25 for an ordinary ticket or £50 for a VIP ticket. Now, I'm assuming that means you get to meet the band, but it doesn't say. It's all seated as well. Now, we have a show called Quadrophenia, which is a live performance of The Who's album Quadrophenia, and it's been performed by a group called Goldhawks, and it's going to be on Wednesday, the 24th of October, 7:30 p.m. All tickets £21. All tickets give you a seat. Then we have Roy Ayers, who's performing on Friday the 26th of October. All tickets are £25. All tickets seated. And he is a superb vibraphonist, it says. I have never said those words before. I'll say them again. A superb vibraphonist. So if you're a fan of the vibraphone, that's for you. Now, Saturday the 27th of October, somebody I think we've all heard of, a one-man show by Andy Hamilton. And he'll be there at 7:30 p.m. It's all tickets are £20, all tickets obviously seated. Then we have a play, that I assume is a one-woman play, The Diary of Anne Frank, which is a newly adapted version of a stage play about Anne Frank's life. And that's on three evenings, the 1st, the 2nd and the 3rd of November. It's at 7:30 each evening. It's being performed by, or put on by, a group called Cat's Act, but it doesn't say how much it will cost you. Then we have Foster and Allen doing a two-man concert on Wednesday, the 7th of November. All tickets £25, all tickets seated, and they've been 4 decades in the music business. Then Friday, the 9th of November, we have Thank ABBA for the Music, which is a tribute band for ABBA. That will be starting at 7:30 p.m. All tickets £19.50, all tickets seated. And we have Miles Hunt, The Custodian Tour, and that's on Saturday, the 10th of November, 8 p.m. All tickets £16, all tickets seated. And it says here, The Wonder Stuff's Miles Hunt embarks on a solo acoustic tour of the UK. Then finally, the real thing again, Wishbone Ash, are performing on Wednesday the 14th of November, 7:30 p.m. All tickets £22.50 and all tickets seated. And it says you'll discover why they're such an enduringly successful group if you go along and listen to them. Right, let's head south to the Abbey Theatre for some drama. And a reminder that the play, which floored me completely in the last recording, runs on into our period, which is J.B. Priestley's Dangerous Corner. It's his first time play, and the most famous is An Inspector Calls. There we are. I managed to say it properly. I completely failed last month. Anyway, that is being performed again on the 16th to the 20th of October at 8 p.m. The Sunday matinee. No, that was on the 14th. So that's just evening performances. There will be an audio described production. I didn't know that last time I previewed it, but they don't yet know which evening will have the audio description, I'm afraid. Now, we then move on to the St Albans Chamber Opera, who will be giving you An Evening with Gilbert and Sullivan. Simply an evening. In fact, it's two evenings. It's in the Studio Theatre. The evenings concerned are the 25th and the 26th of October, and it's at 8 p.m. each evening. And then finally, something which I can guarantee is not going to be a barrel of laughs, we have the Electra, as written by Sophocles in a modern translation, and that's being performed by the Company of Ten, and that will be on the 9th and 10th of October, and then the 13th, 14th, 15th, 16th and 17th. Now, all those performances are at 8 p.m, and then there's a Sunday matinee on the 11th at 2 p.m. Right, there's a play on in Wheatamstead from the 25th to the 27th of October, and it's a play by Charlotte Keatley, being performed in the Memorial Hall, and it's entitled My Mother Said I Never Should. And it's an insight into complex relationships between mothers and daughters, moving backwards and forwards through the lives of four women experiencing great social change of the 20th century. And I think that's going to be at 7:30 p.m. Tickets are usually available from the Manor Pharmacy in Wheatamstead High Street. Now, we have a performance of Macbeth by Shakespeare, and that's going to be at the Maltings Theatre, and that's going to be on the 25th of October, running through to the 17th of November. That's quite a long season. And on the 25th to 28th of October, 7th to 10th of November, and 14th to 17th of November, it's 7:30 p.m. each evening, and tickets are £12 down to £7.50. There don't appear to be any matinees, and it is being performed by OVO itself. Now, going across to the Sandpit Theatre, we have a spoof play entitled Not Lady Chatterley's Lover, which looks like a farce broadly based on the D.H. Lawrence novel. And that's one performance only on Saturday, the 27th of October. It's 7:30 p.m. and tickets for it will cost £10. But you do have to be over 16 to go and see it. And we've got two other plays, rather different. Monday, the 9th of October at 11:30 a.m. and 2:30 p.m. there's a play called Russell, performed by the Paddleboat Theatre Company, and it's all about the experience of having adventures in the open air. And then on Saturday, the 3rd of November, again 11:30 a.m. and 2:30 p.m. a play called Butterflies, an uplifting tale of friendship and courage, it says, and tickets for that are £7 or £5, and that's performed actually by a company that calls itself the Butterflies Show. Now, the Trestle Arts Base has got one play on in our period. It's called Payne's Plough Pop Music. It's on Saturday the 3rd of November at 7:30 p.m, finishes at 9, and it's a play about kind of problems on the dance floor. Anyone who's ever been a fool on the dance floor, it says. A wedding, a free bar, a blast from the past, a lot of music as well as acting. He says it's an emotionally contagious roller coaster, and you'll have a night at the theatre like no other. Okay, you have to be over 14 to buy a ticket, and the tickets will cost you £12 or £10. And the last play we've got also has a lot of music in it. It's Sunday the 11th of November. It's at the Maltings. It starts at 8 p.m. and it's entitled Harvey Hallam, An Ordinary Man. And it's a one-act play by Alison Raymond telling the story of a London draper cast into extraordinary circumstances after volunteering for military service in the First World War. And there'll be singing by Martin Ollyett, Bob Templeman and Annette Burrows. Tickets for that are £12 or £10. And the last thing to preview is the annual Fireworks Spectacular, which is put on in aid of local charities and staged by the Cathedral in Verulamium Park. That is going to be on Saturday the 3rd of November. The fireworks will be set off at 7:30 p.m. prompt. And there's an interesting comment in the programme this year, which answers a question which a lot of us have posed ourselves over the years. How upsetting do the birds find all these fireworks going off? Because they are very loud and very bright. And the answer is that the RSPB has monitored the situation and found that it doesn't seem to upset the birds unduly, and they're all back on their roost within 2 hours of the whole event finishing. So, for once, you can know that you can go there with a clear conscience for the wildlife and enjoy all the whizzes and bangs to your heart's content. So, I'll be back with you next month in the run-up for Christmas.
I have three guests in the studio today from the Ver Poets. Terry Jones is chair. Anna Avebury is a member of the group, as is Chris Delaney. Looking at poetry on radio is quite tricky. People who are listening to this now, like me, will be saying, well, hang on a minute, what do I know about poetry? I know a fair amount about novels and fiction because that's in my daily life. I probably read that more often than anything else. Crime fiction is the greatest pleasure and popularly at the moment, apparently. But also film and TV are much more based on the narrative structures of what we would think of as fiction, as novels, as it were. Poetry, to many people, is a bit scary. Do you find that in your own experience, this is what you've been through to get here?
It can be seen as scary, but it's a very interesting point that you're making about poetry and the radio, because radio is actually poetry's natural medium, because poetry essentially should be heard. It isn't, unlike a novel, something that you take away and curl up with and spend the afternoon reading. You can read poetry silently to yourself, but poetry is best appreciated when it is actually heard. And so it's something that we've had to get used to doing as poets, emerging poets, and that is actually daring to read our poems to an audience. Red Kites Over Home Farm. They ride the autumn air, forked tails fluttering in warm updrafts, wings outstretched. Together they hover, then stoop, a heartbeat apart, each mirroring the other as the carousel turns and they circle the field below. The practiced rise and fall, a daily rite, like hands at the piano, in perfect time. They know the score too well, waiting for the cue, the breeze that spells decay, then the targeted descent to lunch below.
I remember discovering poetry at school, just in the school library, and picking out these books. Actually, they were little black penguin books called Penguin Modern Poets.
Oh, yes.
And they weren't on the curriculum. And I thought, even though I didn't really understand all of it, I thought, this is brilliant. And I think a lot of people come to poetry very, very young. But the fear for me was that I had no one to talk to about liking it, really. And when I started writing, I remember doing this, writing in the library, I'd have my arm over the book so people couldn't see that I was writing,
poetry.
And it's because I thought it was, I guess I thought it was a bit unmanly. I mean, we're talking 1960s.
Yes, 1960s, right.
But there was something, you know, I had no models. It's just something I discovered and I thought, this is terrific.
I do remember writing my first poem, and it was something private, and I didn't want to share it with anyone else. But I do remember that when I started writing poetry as an adult, I mean, I'd started reading it in my teens, but when I started writing it, I was quite keen to find a way to get it published. And so I was looking for magazines, for outlets for it. I did want to share it.
No, well, I did write poetry from a very young age.
Oh, right, okay.
Really. But I didn't have any idea, clear idea about what I wanted to do with it or whether I wanted to be a poet as I got older. Fortunately, I did have a teacher who was very encouraging. She was one of these teachers who could really impart their love of the English language and of poetry and of the written word generally. And she really did help. In fact, I was fortunate enough to have a first poetry pamphlet published last year. And my teacher came along, didn't she, to the launch, which was lovely of her to come along for that. And I dedicated the book to her, of course.
Terry, you talked about when you were a student. Now, anybody who's been at school ever has read poetry because it's somewhere on the curriculum, isn't it?
Yes.
So it's not that we're not exposed to it. Is it that we're given the wrong impression of it?
We all read text all the time. And normally the purposes for reading are getting information. And we learn to read quite quickly. We study is mainly reading. So something else happens in poetry. It's not just about the meaning. Something else goes on. And whatever that thing was, is what I picked up when I started reading these Penguin Modern Poets. There was an excitement there. Here's the thing. I didn't always know. In fact, very often didn't know what it actually meant. But I knew it was exciting and I knew I wanted to discover what it meant. So there was a kind of journey. The meaning wasn't apparent.
No.
But there was something about the sound, the ideas, images, words doing things that you didn't know words could do that were more parallel to other forms of art like music, which I loved, the visual arts, rather than, if you like, study, history, books. And so it's discovering that words did something new and exciting and unique, and I wanted more of it.
Is it that there is nobody who attempts to be a poet if they don't love language?
It's language as a medium in the way that painters love paint or musicians will love their musical instrument. You know, they might polish the violin and really look, take care of it. But I think research has been done which shows that the centres in the brain that are stimulated by music are also stimulated by poetry. And so when you mentioned the kind of music of a poem, and that, I think, is what was coming across to me when I was reading as a teenager, I think what I was enjoying unconsciously, because I wasn't reading it out aloud, I was experiencing it on the page. But you could still feel that there was a kind of song there. It was musical. And I think that's something that I continue to treasure about poetry. But that's only one dimension. It has lots of different dimensions.
Many of us have much more experience of the novel, of fiction, than we do of poetry. Yeah,
including us, by the way.
I devour novels. I love, there's nothing I love more than curling up for the afternoon with a good book.
And so you're
reading.
Saying you're looking there again for the sense of the love of language.
Other things come in novels, aren't they? It sort of refers to either magical worlds or the world that we know, or characters, or even or puzzles, you know. So I used to love detective novels and thrillers. Well, used to, still do, because there's a puzzle. William Butler Yeats, great, great Irish poet, loved Agatha Christie. And that's how he relaxed.
I think when you're reading a novel, I think it is, it's a very different type of reading experience. I think relaxation, well, is poetry meditative? I find fiction meditative.
Yeah, it can be.
So that when I lose myself on the page in that world with those characters, it's a slightly different kind of interaction, so that when I finish a good book, a book I've really enjoyed, I miss it. I miss the people. I think, well, what happened? You know, well, what happened about that bit? What happened afterwards? You know, when they're living happily ever after. What else happens?
Yes.
So there's that sense of connection. When you come to the end of a poem, I think you're left with different thoughts, different feelings. It's more a, oh, I see. Oh, I understand. I feel when I'm reading poetry, what I'm getting is insight, another way of thinking about an emotion, or another way of seeing emotions, or another way of seeing a tree, or of thinking about relationships, experiences. So it's a slightly different experience, I think, to reading fiction.
And everything's rather shortened, isn't it?
It is.
I think that's
you have to get the points across quite succinctly. And I think, as you sort of were talking about, finding new ways to express things that are familiar to us, so that you suddenly wake up and think, wow, you know.
Yes. There's a lovely poem by Daphne Gloag in this book that we published last year, which tries to imagine what it would be like if you were a sundial. That's on the one hand really weird, but also rather amazing, you know. And so there's a little leap of imagination, and then suddenly a different way of looking at the world opens up in, what, 10 lines? Tiny amount of text.
Yeah. You've talked quite often about the shortness, the brevity of poetry by comparison with other media, because its history is far from brief.
It used to do, in pre-literate societies, what novels do now. So in other words, the big stories, the big imaginative stories, the soap operas, were told in poetry. They were actually written down performances of stories that were very important in society, that dealt with things that people in society cared about. So they were the entertainment, the education for people who were not literate.
Yes. Some would argue that we're in a post-literate era, in that words on pages are not read as often for the same reasons as they might have been in the past. Is there time for poetry to go back to that length, that declamation? That,
of course, there are all these new media now. In fact, there's a whole range of new poets who read on YouTube, Instagram. Is it Rupi Kaur who's become a best-selling poet from doing stuff on, I think, on Instagram?
And self-publishing in that way. Yeah. She put her own poems into the public domain. Yeah. She didn't go via a literary agent. Yeah. She didn't go via a publishing house. You didn't have to wait to be accepted or rejected. Yeah. Yeah. She just published.
Sure. There is actually a constant reinvention of poetic utterance, if you like. Years ago, rap is new things now, isn't it? But of rhymed, semi-sung verses has been a very important influence, certainly a couple of decades ago. And I think people still are talked about as rap. Slam poets.
And performance poetry is very popular. It may be more popular with younger members of the audience, but there has been quite a lively debate as to its status, because although it's primarily performed, it can also be written down.
Yeah, I mean, Kate Tempest is the best example. Was a performance poet. She's probably in her late 30s now, but sells a lot of books, as well as doing a lot of gigs.
And there are lots of poetry festivals, and there are lots of poetry readings. I think, in a strange way, unlike fiction, poetry is a very communal media. It's keeping going what was happening in those pre-literate days, when people gathered in the mead hall to hear Beowulf, this story of this wonderful Anglo-Saxon hero. And people continue to gather to listen to poems. So you might write in isolation, you know, the cliche of the poet, the artist in the garret, penning these wonderful poems like Shakespeare and Shakespeare in Love. There may be an essence of truth still there. We all retreat to write, but we join with other people to read it. Although poetry books do sell to a certain extent, I think there's a lot more in the communal visiting of poetry festivals and other forms of literary festivals to actually hear poetry being read out loud and sharing that with other people.
Is that why Verpoets exists? Is that what it's for, to bring people together who otherwise would be in the garrets writing on their
own? I think
up to a point. think it was set up by a lady 50, 60 years ago?
50 years ago.
And the aim there was to bring poems to a group of like-minded people to get them torn apart or critted or... And that's your first audience in a way. And we still do that. All three of us go to sessions like that where you hand in a poem. But yeah, I mean, broadly, what we're trying to do is promote the enjoyment of poetry. For me, that is writing, but it's also reading. Mm. And I think the reading of poetry is the thing that we should do more of. Even people who write poetry, if you ask them what they read, a lot of them say, well, I don't read very much. And you think, well, how do you think you're going to get better unless you watch the masters and mistresses of the art? You know, if you want to be better, read what other people have done.
When I joined Ver Poets is really when my poetry started to take off. I'd started writing. I knew I was enjoying it. I'd had one or two things published. But joining Ver Poets brought me into contact with people who knew more than I did or had a little bit more experience than I did.
Yes, I found that
Did
too.
You find that, Chris, as well, when you joined? And people would suddenly say, have you read? Or going to the workshops and sharing a poem and people suggesting, well, you know, have you thought of leaving out that line and, you know, putting it this way? And suddenly you start to see things in a slightly different way.
Yes, you do. And also being able to comment on other people's poetry too is useful in that it makes you think and react to different types of poetry that necessarily you might not have
encountered
or looked at before.
Exactly.
So that's been very useful.
Yeah, learning to give good feedback is a really important and I think underrated
true.
Skill.
Yeah. Well, even now I tend not to. I tend to be the one that sort of sits back a bit, you know, and I always feel other people are more knowledgeable than I am, but I am getting more confident.
Yeah. I think that's what comes of joining a group like Ver Poets, and I think what people are looking for when they inquire about membership is this like-mindedness so that they don't feel as if they're on their own anymore and that they're going to have some sort of shared experience and perhaps gain through that association. So coming to the meetings, coming to the workshops, that it will be a way of nurturing what they've discovered they enjoy doing themselves.
True. But like-mindedness has got a reverse side as well, which is that they might feel that they're all too like-minded and I'm not going to be able to fit into that. I haven't done beyond GCSE English. Yeah. Where, how do I get into this? I think, Chris, you came to this quite late. You said something earlier.
I did. I had a long break from writing poetry from the age, really, of 16 when I left school. I started work in a factory and became a wireman, making parts for aircraft. Then, after that, I tried to become an artist, a commissioning artist, which worked for about 2 years. And then I became a self-employed gardener, which is what I do to this day. And so I had a break of 3 decades before I came back to writing poetry. And it was really only when my school teacher from secondary school contacted me via the Friends Reunited website, which is not there now, it's defunct. But we exchanged emails and she sort of started to encourage me again and said, well, you really should join a local poetry society.
So she must have seen something there that even at the age of 16.
This poem is called Ardnish Peninsula, Scotland, and it's one of the poems from my debut collection. Snug inside the belly of your two-man tent, we watch pipistrelles quarter evening sky, harvesting air. Hear the river thrum the harp of a sheep's jawbone. By dawn, melody softens to measured intimacy. Scrolled fabric reveals in brightening light red deer poised along our horizon for the length of a heartbeat. From a coastal path, I see grey seals far below, draped on quartzite tongued by breakers. And when sun's warmth snaps gorse pods, we snuffle sweet coconut. You trace with careful fingers the pattern of a fossilised tree across a rock face. Relate how the pulse of time oscillates from crystals, and I begin to believe in the possibility of permanence.
Is Chris unusual? I mean, and the other two of your ex-teachers, and I sort of assume that would not be uncommon.
There are lots of people like Chris who they've had an interest. They've written things, but they haven't developed it. I mean, I stopped writing because of life. You know, I had a career, I had a family, I was bringing up kids. And for me, you need a bit of space in your head to do this playing around that we talked about or finding that interesting. So I only started writing again when I could see retirement coming. And somehow my kids were getting older. They didn't need us all the time. So I began to get ideas for poems. So there was dormancy, certainly. But I think a lot of people get bitten by the bug very, very early. Lots of people, by the way, write in their teenage bedrooms, don't they? And then stop it. For all sorts of reasons.
As you say, life gets in the way.
Yeah.
But also the thinking, well, actually, this is doggerel, I'll stop now.
That is the other thing, you know. Is what I've written any good? Because you want it to be good. Mm. You don't want to write rubbish. And actually, the more you write, you realise that writing really well is really hard. Most of what you write, let me speak for myself, most of what I write is rubbish. It's because you're trying to get it right. I've actually seen people in other arts take ages over an image, a little bit of a painting or a drawing, or going over and over a musical phrase just to get that right.
Just to get it.
And I think that when you care about it, it's like an infinite capacity for taking pains.
Yes.
And I think that's really quite important. There's a bit of, you know, people think about it as inspiration, but, you know, a lot of it is perspiration.
It is.
Well,
the inspiration is,
that's where the idea comes from.
For me...
But then you have to work very hard at the skills.
It's very different for different writers, but for me, it's an idea that begins to just form in your head. And sometimes it's a phrase, sometimes it's a rhythm, sometimes it's just... You know, I've written some poems about trees in my garden, and they've come from living with these trees and watching things happen to them over the course of a year. And eventually, suddenly an idea will come about my relationship to this tree, or the apple that's just fallen off it, or the leaves that have just vanished overnight in a wind or whatever. Yeah, the short answer, yes, it's an idea.
Why Must I Tell You? By John Hussey. Why must I tell you about the elms? Born after they had gone, you never saw how, in New Year mists, they'd stand at anchor on fields of sticks, or how, in autumn sunsets, they'd blaze like ruined churches, traceries framing the perfect blue. You couldn't know why, on school tomorrow Sunday drives back home, I'd pick one waiting far ahead and watch that massive permanence go by until it slipped behind a hedge or little chef, arms still raised in recognition. Tomorrow it would still be there, unchanging through the day I'd feared. Why must I tell you about the elms? No, it's not just that they were beautiful and doomed, erased from the landscape like a vanished tribe. It's my selfish need to see live on what I felt about them too. The hope that somewhere, in a barren field, this memory might just take hold and raise an arm to the world still hurtling by.
Now, I expected that conversation to last about 15 or 20 minutes, but in fact we chatted for almost an hour, including my guest reading half a dozen poems. So rather than chop them off in their prime, which I appear to have done just then, I'm actually bringing them back again, this time talking a bit more about how any of us might get involved in writing our own thoughts and ideas, and more about Ver Poets as an organisation, its competitions, its publications and so on.
We now have this month's Thought for the Day. The music that follows the Thought for the Day is played by the Hertfordshire Chorus, and we thank them for allowing us to use it.
Hello, and a warm welcome to Journey, the Thought for the Week from Torch Trust. I'm Jan Turner, and I'd like to share my thoughts. I'm reading from Braille, as I'm a Braille reader. My thoughts are on new things. What do you think about doing new things? Are you filled with dread, and because of your fear, you don't actually do the new things that you were thinking about? Or do you push yourself Then, when you have done it, you feel proud, believe that you will be able to do it again. As a visually impaired person, I'm often required to do new things, like find a new route or try new technology, which is always challenging, make a new recipe, which sometimes doesn't go as you planned, meet new people. These are all experiences that I'm sure you will have had too. Maybe at the moment you're being challenged to start something new. My granddaughter was not looking forward to going back to school after the school holidays because she had a new teacher that she didn't particularly like. Now that she is back, though, at school, it isn't as bad as she thought. She's even beginning to like her new teacher. I did a new thing recently. I led a service for a family who wanted to scatter ashes for their loved one. Although I felt some anxiety before the service, it turned out to be a lovely experience which blessed both me and the family. In the Bible, when Jesus called his disciples, they were required to leave everything behind and follow him. Little did they know what the new life with Jesus would mean. The most wonderful new thing that you can do, if you haven't before, is to put your trust in Jesus, and he will help you whatever new things you are attempting to do. Jesus says that in the end, he will make all things new. There will be a new heaven and a new earth. Then everything will be as it should be. I'm really looking forward to that. You've been listening to Journey, produced by Torch Trust, a Christian organisation for people at any stage of the sight loss journey. Did you know that Torch Trust offers Torch Talk, friendship, support, prayer and Bible study in small groups by phone? In fact, it is my job at Torch Trust to organise these friendly groups. So if you'd like to join one, just call Torch Trust on 01858 438 260. Till next time, it's goodbye and God bless.